Welcome back. I'm Andy Parker, and this is the UX Coach Podcast. This is the show that explores design and research careers in the digital industry. In this episode, I'm in conversation with Hugo Jenkins, owner of The 25th Company, a user experience and product design consultancy from Melbourne, Australia. Hugo and his wife also run Things for Kids, a children's activity directory born from their own experiences of becoming parents and the struggles with well-being and the all-important work-life balance. We discuss overcoming the fears of leaving traditional employment life and going out on your own as a contractor or starting your own business, the connections between musicians and designers, and the bygone era of MySpace skinning. More information can be found in the show notes at theuxcoach.com. Let's not waste any more time and get on with the show. Welcome to the UX Coach Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure to have you. Thank you for staying up. It's quite bizarre to think that 12 hours ago I was telling you I was going to bed and here we are the following day and you're still in the same place.
Yeah. It's the curse of Melbourne and the eastern coast of Australia. Working with anyone in Europe or anyone in America is almost impossible.
But the powers of time travel somehow make it work.
Yes, that's right.
I'd really like to talk to you about a whole bunch of things today, but let's start off with just what it is that you're doing now. So you run your own consultancy with your wife, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Yep, the 25th company. We do all sorts of varied UX activities. So I do user research or product design or more UI-focused stuff for content around design and user experience. And my wife runs another business called thingsforkids.com.au, which is a children's activity directory, for parents struggling with mental health in the early stages of having a child. She and I run the company and have been doing so for the last couple of years. Yeah, it all came about because we were having a child and needed a little bit more flexibility. You know, I was working at an agency which, you know, in Australia is a little bit more demanding than other than working, you know, enterprise or in a consultancy or something like that. We went out on our own to get a bit more flexibility and be able to work in an arrangement that would let us raise our children as well as still maintaining some kind of income and sanity as well, I guess.
Mm. Been going okay so far?
Yeah, so we mostly do, like, well, I say we, I mean I mostly do financial services consulting, 50-50 with startup work or experimentation, doing my own projects and that sort of stuff, which is really good. It works for me because I can do 6 months in a financial services, you know, an insurance or a big bank or something like that. In Australia, that's one of the surest ways in user experience to find solid work, getting into the financial services industry, because it's one of the industries that has the money in Australia to really pay for a lot of extensive UX activities and user research. And, you know, generally they're becoming a little bit more mature in terms of the technology that they're using. So, yeah, I do consulting in the financial services. I try to keep it 50-50 with doing stuff that's more interesting. You know, not that building marketing sites for, big banks is not interesting. It's just a different side of the sword, I guess. You know, and I like to keep both sides of it relatively sharp.
Sure. What's the kind of current state of design in general, would you say, in Australia? Because I think if I think back to a few years ago, let's say like 5 or 6 years ago, I was having a lot of conversations with people who were either emigrating back into Europe or the UK, or that they were heading over. And I got a lot of mixed messages. And there's only a handful of really big organizations that I know have got like big, heavy bases within sort of tech in Australia, and the main one being Atlassian. What else is going on? Like, where's the maturity level with things at the moment?
It really varies. You know, like I would have said, that period you were talking about, 5-10 years ago, I would have said that we were 5 years behind, 3 years behind, the leading the thought leaders in the US and the UK and other parts of Europe. But now, as some organizations have become a lot more mature quite quickly, there's been a bit of an injection of a bit more energy into the space, as people have seen investing in design and investing in user experience and technology in general, like starting to return some dividends for companies that did make that initial investment a little bit later than the rest of the world. But yeah, now I feel like it's you know, you could do work as well in San Francisco or London as you could in Melbourne or Sydney, but you have to be at the right spot. You know, it has to be in the right environment, and it has to be the right mindset with the team. And there's a lot of things that need to sort of fall into place.
Right.
There has been a big growth in Australia in the last sort of 2 to 3 years. We've had more of the sort of pop-up, the businesses, you know, General Assembly and Academy XI and those kind of places like coming in. And there's a big demand for services in markets like Singapore and Hong Kong and, you know, Tokyo, Japan to a lesser extent. But Australian designers are finding work in those places, which are often light years ahead of where they've come from in Australia, yeah. Purely because it's just at a bigger scale, or, you know, they're working for companies that are multinational that do have bigger hubs in Singapore or Hong Kong.
Sure.
I feel like people have come up to speed. But that's purely from my perspective, you know, like you could be working in one organization and then, you know, the next week in another one in the same building, and that could be completely, you know, different in terms of design practices and
right. So on. You mentioned there about working with people in the US and across Europe. Does that mean that quite a lot of the work that you get involved in ends up being with distributed teams?
In Australia, that is sometimes necessary, even between cities like Melbourne and Sydney. But it's also harder because the internet infrastructure in Australia is really bad. You might have noticed from the quality of the call that it's not Australia is not set up for success when it comes to you know, remote working infrastructure. That's something that still has got a long way to go, and unfortunately the government policy doesn't seem to really be supporting the growth in that sector. Mm. So that's something that does hold back remote engagement. But I'm on a contract at the moment with a financial services client where the team works 40% at home and 60% in the office, development and design. The interface with the New Zealand office, that's something that's quite common in Australian industry. There might be an Australian office and a New Zealand office because both, you know, New Zealand market is smaller but a bit more progressive, and they're willing to take things up, and it's a good testing ground for a lot of organisations. So, for instance, I worked at an accounting firm, MYOB, which is a big sort of incumbent, dominant player in accounting in Australia, and they have a New Zealand. They're very much big in New Zealand as well as Australia, and there was a lot of remote, you know, sessions for those kind of engagements, because, you know, the product people are all in New Zealand and the developers are in Melbourne and the analysts are in Sydney. So, you know, there's quite a bit of remote sort of communication necessary, even just between local cities, you know?
Right.
So yeah, there has been, you know, in the last sort of 6 months to 12 months, of people have been starting to be a bit more friendly to it. My last couple of engagements have been ones where I've done at least one day at home or 2 days at home, which for me is great. You know, little kids, hard to walk out the door every day at 7:30 and not be back until, you know, bath time or whatever.
Mm.
So yeah, that we've come a long way in that regard as well.
Right. One of the things that I was really interested about when we were talking before was the decisions to leave agency life and leave employed life and go, yep, self-employed and starting your own business because of that work-life balance, which,
yep,
is important to all of us. But to do that when you've got small children or children on the way, I can imagine is quite daunting for a lot of people. What were the things that you did in preparation for that to give you the confidence to take that leap?
That's a good question. That's one that my wife and I have reflected on, you know, sort of regularly throughout the journey, because we wanted to validate that we were, you know, doing the right thing and going down the right path. I've always been of an entrepreneurial sort of spirit or bent. Like I've tried, you know, multiple different sort of business design businesses and a few other things, you know, mostly online, but also music related because I'm a musician as well. And I always thought my dad, when I was 20 or something like that, after getting pissed off for being at work or something like that, told me, it's like, don't worry, you do this for a little while and then you'll be much happier once you start your own business and, you know, do your own thing. And I was like, not really sure that's who I am at age 20 or whatever. But I kind of found over the years that I, you know, I was always had a side project going that would take a lot of time. And you know, so I already I had that motivation, which without it would be impossible. You know, like there's no way, I don't think you could motivate yourself. You know, it's very difficult to find an external motivation when you want to do something that is quite daunting, like going out on your own. But because the motivation was always internal, it did seem, daunting is not the word, you know, like I worried. I worried about not being able to provide for my family, because that was very much going to be my role for the first sort of 12 months of the situation.
Yeah.
We had quite a rocky start with our first son. He was a month or so premature, and he had a lot of reflux. And also, as first-time parents, we don't have the grandparents around in Melbourne. I moved over from Perth sort of 10, 12 years previously for work because there was no work in Perth. So, you know, we left all that behind, essentially. So we really struggled, and both really struggled with postnatal depression. And we were in and out of the hospital a little bit for that first sort of month to 6 weeks, and everything was cool. You know, like Wolfgang, our son, is fine. So that's really great. But we just needed a bit more flexibility. You know, like I was working at this agency, which was, you know, great people, a very young group of people who wanted to do more technology-focused things and were trying to be proactive for their clients. And, you know, like it was a good agency sort of atmosphere and really sort of energizing. But the trade-off is that you have to keep up with the pace and keep churning it out, especially when you're on a big client that's got a lot of visibility, or, you know, it's one of the bigger accounts in the company. And as a UX person, you're so often working on business critical decisions, you know, like the design of a ticket booking system, for instance, for an airline, which I worked on at the agency. That's the only driver for that business's revenue, you know, so there's a lot of pressure involved in getting things right. So there's a lot of pressure and a lot of tension, and we were a couple of months into having a child. Wolfgang was 2 or 3 months, I think, and it was just too hard. We really had to find an alternative where I could work from home or a bit less and be a bit more flexible with the time that I would come in. So I went out and did the crazy, like, frantic networking of a designer who doesn't really enjoy participating in sort of design events. You know, I'm not antisocial, but like I like going to events like that, but I also enjoy just sitting in the back of the room with a beer, you know, like I like to watch and assess rather than, you know, fully engage sometimes. You know, that took a lot of effort to do. But when I found a client who was a startup client who could employ me only because of a tax break that they were getting from the government for research and development, I was able to sort of put together a work schedule that worked for them and worked for us. And so once, you know, starting off on my own, because it was so similar to just going and finding a job, finding a client, you know, as a contract user experience practitioner, very similar, you know, you're quite invested in it. It's hard to just freelance for a couple of weeks and, you know, get to know all the stakeholders and, you know, get everything right very, very quickly. You know, that's very hard to do. So, I was quite used to the process already. It was just the putting on the face of, all right, this is new and you're going to be doing it by yourself, but it's the same. You know, really, it's the same. You just have to go out and sell yourself to people and try and find something that will be sustainable for you to work on, as well as profitable and making business sense.
So would you say that the whole working in an agency really meant it gave you the tools that and skills that you needed to be able to get this going?
No, I would say it was much more so my network of past, colleagues and peers in the industry. So the client I ended up working for the first sort of 16, 17 months of the business was run by a guy, the CTO. It was a startup, and they were doing online sort of grocery deliveries from local grocers. It's called Your Grocer, and it was a great company to work in. The only reason I was working there was because the CTO had been a developer at MYOB. You know, he was at a consulting firm who consulted to MYOB. I'd worked with him on a software design project, writing some web software that was very similar to what, technologies that Your Grocer worked in. So, when I put out into the network that this was, I was going out on my own and he was one of the guys that I sort of targeted, and that was how that came around. So it was working in the agency. I really wanted to work in an agency because it was something that I hadn't done before. Like, I'd worked in consulting firms where you're out somewhere and you don't have very much interaction with the rest of the consulting right. staff, but the agency sort of thing, working on bigger sort of retail clients and that sort of thing, I hadn't done. And I wanted to know how they managed their accounts and did the sales process and so on, because I was kind of considering going out on my own. So that was good preparation. But at the end of the day, I discarded a lot of what I learned at the agency in that respect, because I wanted to do it my way. Yeah. So I didn't want to be doing it the same way a big multinational agency would do it. But yeah, it was more the experiences beforehand as well, and the network and being good to people and trying to do good work for them. Sure.
When you're in a big agency like that, one of the things that I do enjoy with it is the support infrastructure that you have around you of all your colleagues, and there'll be people at different levels, right, where you can go to this particular person to get advice and direction on one thing, and then there'll be somebody else that has got their strain, and you can go and sort of grab them for that.
Yeah.
How do you keep developing your own personal skills and the things that you know about now that you run your own business?
I would say that's probably the hardest aspect of it, of trying to run our own ship, because we are stuck in the position of trying to sell our services for quite a high cost, comparatively speaking. It's important to be seen to be like to know about these up to date methods and learning as much as you can and doing as much professional development as would be usual. But finding the time to do it and knowing some structure, what structure to put around it, and that's been a lot more difficult for me in while working for myself, for sure, because that's something that I never really thought about, because, when you're applying for a job, I always took the approach of like to try and find something how to do sort of 60% of, so you can, in a sort of relatively safe space, you can upskill, and as long as you're open and transparent about it when you go into it, you can be upfront about learning and so on. And this was a completely opposite approach. You just had to say, oh yeah, no worries, like I can definitely do that for you, Google. I do try to really vary my work as a way to drive that sort of professional development, so that I can do both, client work and professional development sort of.
Yeah. So finding the opportunities where it's going to, the project itself will lead towards exploring new avenues.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So for instance, I had established a relationship with Usability Hub, who are the remote 5-second test, screen testing survey sort of tool. And they're based in Melbourne. I developed a relationship with those guys over a period of time, and I went to do a content and research role there, which I'd never done before, but I was getting more interested in writing, and I thought, well, why not try and develop that skill? Why not try and go and find a gig that would, you know, find a gig where you can write about something that you know about already so that you can work on the writing part and not have to worry about the content or, you know, how that's going to develop. So that was an example of the sort of 60-40 sort of approach. It ended up being about, I think I knew how to do 8% of that job and I had to learn the rest of 92% in between. So that was a bit harrowing. But, I think the outcome, the overall outcome was a positive one.
Let's take a step back a little bit and tell us about... I was instantly drawn to your profile because you've got a very similar background to me. It seems like you started off in music and then ended up coming over to this sort of technology side. So I'm really interested how you go from producing music to being a UX designer.
I don't think this is an uncommon character trait in some UXs. I think there are clans of UXs and musicians is a clan, like a clan within the practice of UX, because I have met so many over the years, even just in Australia, you know, locally where I usually do work. So my mum was always very musical and she taught us to play the piano and the importance of music and, you know, being the universal language or something like that. I went to high school and my parents weren't well off, but my dad worked as a minister and he was on the board of a very fancy sort of school in Perth. So I went to a fancy school for a few years and trained to be like an orchestral musician, a tuba player. So I got into the conservatorium at the University of WA and tried it out for a little while, but decided it wasn't really, it's taking the passion away from music for me, you know, like trying to learn in a really structured environment like that. So I kicked it in the head. And the other thing that my mum was an academic and we always had computers around because of dad as well. He worked just before he became a minister. So she would get us to make websites, you know, in the mid 90s when that was a thing that, you know, was a very difficult thing to do. So, you know, my brother and I worked on like her websites and her university lecture, you know, systems and stuff, just because we knew how to operate computers basically and could search on AltaVista or whatever about how to look up things and how to put pages together. So I got started off as a developer and after I quit my music degree, after a while of working in record stores and such, I fell back on my development skills and, worked as a freelance web designer and then got a job at a small agency in Perth after going to a trade school for a little while. And, you know, someone at the trade school got a tap on the shoulder from this agency in Perth and said, oh, have you got any students that, you know, might be good? So I went off and worked for this agency for a little while. And I kind of worked myself into design because as a web designer back in the late 90s, early 2000s, that you had to know about everything, right? Like you just had to do everything and take care of everything. You had to know about the design and you had to know how to put the front end together and how to script things. And so I had to do a bit of everything. But the thing that I liked the most was the design bit. And I slowly started doing more user experience activities in my sort of design role. And I remember the first card sort that I did at a front end development job with an HR, you know, department. It was really burning fire in me. I think this was probably 2006 or something like that, 2007 maybe. I kind of gradually worked myself into it from being a front-end developer. Yeah, that's kind of how I came to it. And it wasn't until I moved to Melbourne in 2010 or something like that, or 2012, a while ago, to work at Stanford, which was a consultancy in Melbourne who had a lot of big Australian names in user experience, Ruth Ellison, who I'd seen speaking at an Edge of Web or something like that conference, and a few other people. So I thought, oh, you know, let's try this user experience thing on and try and learn from some of the bigger brains that I'd seen, you know, working in other places. It seemed like a gradual progression for me, but it feels quite natural now, you know, like it's, and especially when I find other musician tech user experience people as well, because it's very much the same kind of crowd. and very much the same kind of person.
I totally know what you mean. There's so many people that I've been introduced to through the UXPA who are looking for mentors, where the first thing they say is, well, I was looking for someone and I Googled you and found that you were in a heavy metal band. So you were the person I was going to go to. And I was like, all right, okay, why is that? It's like, oh, because I'm a drummer and I'm in a heavy metal band. Or, you know, I know what you mean. And the actual like progress thing as well, I think, again, is quite common of people of that era. Like, I'm no different. Started off with making stuff for my dad's company, and then people start getting in bands, and bands need websites in the early noughties and, you know, putting things together. So what drives me crazy is that there's two of the biggest like metal bands in the world now, really, are from my area, and one of my like first paid gigs, which was for like £50, was skinning their MySpace page, and now they're signed to Universal and on a massive thing, and my artwork is somewhere on Wayback Machine just collecting dust.
That's amazing. It's I think it's a real shame that we don't have a chance to skin our own social media platforms with the grace that you used to be able to do it with MySpace. I feel like it was the most graceful social media platform because, you know, you had ultimate control. You could just paste that code into any of those text box and, you're all good.
Yeah, right. It was the perfect sandbox of hacking, and I think there's a lot of people that probably learn how to make good and bad design through hacking MySpace, and it got really creative at one point. You know, we're sort of overriding it.
It was so complicated, man. Holy shit.
Do you think that your background and that progression through the web designer era, the jack of all trades and being a developer has helped with communicating with other teams, because you've got a bit of understanding of where they're coming from?
Yeah, look, I think that it does help with that, but I think if you're a nice and normal human being who wants to understand and not be a jerk at work, it's you know, once you have that realization that, oh, if I'm not a jerk to people, if I learn a little bit to understand everyone's lingo, you know, like analysts, you know, C-level, all that sort of thing, everything will go a lot smoother, you know, if you learn a little bit of everyone's speak. I think the thing that it's helped the most in is where you're in a session or in a company or a context where there's no technical people. And there's not a good understanding of what a technology can do. That's when it becomes super useful, because like I'm not, you know, my wife's business runs on it's a Ruby on Rails app, and you know on a Linux box that runs in a VPS host that we have, and that's way over the grade of most people who work in user experience in Australia. Like generally, people in Australia, and I don't know if this is true all globally, but generally people in Australia are very specialized, and it's not uncommon for UX people in Australia to not know about HTML and CSS and what, you know, the basic building blocks of the web and how they work. So having, you know, being able to know how the scripting language works, and you know, like back in my day it was PHP and Perl and those kind of languages, but the concepts are exactly the same, you know, like it, and that's where the value is in knowing about that stuff. It's in when you can bring some slightly tangential experience to your own, you know, focus into a conversation. That's what it's been most useful for. And I feel like that is something that, because there hasn't been a lot of really defined and structured training for people in the design industry, specifically the digital design industry, people tend to come from varied backgrounds and bring something to the party. You know, they come as, you know, an analyst who wants to get more into design, or they come as a product person, or they come from a, you know, teaching children, or they come from a more ergonomics or industrial design, or, you know, like there's varied sort of fields where people come from, at least in my experience in Australia, into user experience. So I came from a development and background. And because everyone comes together from different places, it really benefits a designer to be able to have another sort of string to their bow. I feel like that's probably one of the things that's been most valuable for me. And it doesn't really matter what it is, you know, like if you just know how to edit wicked videos, that is a massive skill that's super useful for a designer to be able to do, you know, like if you can just quickly generate some video content, like, you know, that is massively useful. Or, you know, if you're a really good writer, or if you really know how to structure, you know, project management, you know, and really understand the ins and outs of that, like any of those tangential parallel skills is super handy for designers, I feel. So I think communication is definitely something that's super important, and you need to be able to do that. But I think that's a universal thing that is going to be something you need to work on in each environment that you're in.
Do you think, you know? I mean, being that you're kind of back to where you started in some respects, of that you're quite often a team of one, so you may well be looking at lots of different things. Do you think that those other skills, are they things that make you stand out in the market, of knowing that you can potentially lend your hand to, you know, putting together some sound clips for some media that's being put into Pages? Like, there's lots of pushback, like you said, about the specialisms, and that people should be, you're a user researcher, or you're an interaction designer, or you're a service designer. But we come from an era where you were just a web designer, and it basically meant that you made things that lived on the web, and it didn't really matter what it was. It might be that you've got to put some MP3s together for somebody. It might be that there's a video player that needs to be built, or, you know, back in the day, almost all of us at some point in time has ended up having to create some kind of flash animation, you know, and...
Yeah.
These things seem to have gone away, and now it's like these. You have to be laser focused, but that seems to me to be totally counterintuitive to what the whole point of being a user experience designer was.
Yeah, and when you frame it like that, it's really interesting. I hadn't reflected on that in that way before, but you're totally right in that generalism and flexibility is really something that I think helps, you know, designers in almost every way, and finding work is a lot easier, and interfacing with people is a lot easier. Yeah, because, you know, as technology becomes more specialized and everything is more and more fragmented, you know, the need for, you know, like there's quite a lot of SharePoint use in Australia, right, because there's quite a lot of Microsoft shops around. And if you go to one of the Australian job platforms, job search platforms right now, you could type in SharePoint UX designer and find some very lucrative roles for someone who knows how to, you know, design for SharePoint, which is an incredibly specialized thing that, I mean, I don't know how many SharePoint designers there are in Melbourne or Sydney, but it's not a lot, you know, like there's not many of them.
Isn't that a bit of an oxymoron anyway? Can you actually design for SharePoint? Surely is it just changing the colours and the titles?
I think there's a bit of complexity in that there's a lucrative kind of add-ons market in SharePoint that develops third-party integrations with the way that, you know, with SharePoint as a data source. And I think there's some nuance to it or whatever. I think it's more about process design and knowing about what the data point capabilities are, and knowing about the APIs and these kind of things.
You're seeing this specialism within platforms as well then?
Yeah, for sure. And only within the bigger sort of platforms. That's one of the only examples that kind of comes to mind. I think because businesses see the value in having someone who knows the ins and outs of the design of specific platforms, and who can, the phrase I always hear in every single interview or, you know, sales talk or anything like that is hit the ground running. Like that is every single time I'll hear that, you know, talking to prospective leads or clients, because there's always, you know, Australia's been very big in embracing the agile way of working, and everyone's quite keen on lean and so on, but only because it's a way to save money. And it makes people think that they can get the same result, mm-hmm. but for less money, which, you know, might be true in some cases. But, you know, that hit the ground running mentality is something that, in the space that I work in Australia for sure, is something that is really pervasive. So I think that's where that super fragmentation comes from, is that business now sees the ROI on yeah. having a good designer on the books. You know, it might cost them a couple of $100,000 a year, but the return on it is, you know, is many, many orders of magnitude more than the spend of it. Trying to find the most specialized people that they can is something that rewards business. I think we're going to see more of that as well. It's only going to increase. You're only going to see more Squarespace designer advertisers, you know, and ads for things that are much more specialized. And yeah.
So as a young designer today that's just coming out of grad school or whatever, what advice can you give them for where to start poking? Because if everyone's looking for specialists in specific things, does that mean that the best way of getting exposure to those things would be to try and go in-house at a company maybe, or to go down the agency track, or just try and build their own businesses? What do you think is the best thing for people to do in the current climate?
So I think at the moment there is still a big skew towards designers who can in some way actualize their designs, you know, whether it is in some kind of basic front-end development skills, or knowing how to spin up basic web apps and knowing about that kind of, you know, web stack kind of technology. I would encourage people who are interested in design to learn as much as they can about the canvas, you know, of what mm-hmm. you're going to paint your design on, because it's the properties and the capabilities of the canvas are just as important. They're the limitations, you know, they're the boundaries that you'll be defined, your work will be defined by. Whenever someone asks me, you know, I did a great course, you know, I did a cool boot camp, or I've done you know, design course or fine arts or psychology or something like that, I always tell them to try and find something that they're motivated to do and try to actualize it. So, you know, like if you want to, if you think you've got a cool idea for a social network, you know, just as a pure example, like grab the Rails, you know, tutorials on Treehouse or something like that, and like use the scaffolding to try and run it up. And then, you know, you've got something to work on that is so close to commercial and enterprise kind of experiences that if you know about that sort of stuff, you'll have a massive advantage in the job market. That's the thing that I always suggest to people, but it's kind of problematic because there's always been an argument about whether designers should know how to code and how to make things like that. But I think for me, it's more important to, you know, as someone who's been on the other side of the hiring desk a couple of times, motivation is really important when you're looking to hire specifically juniors or mid-level or graduate designers. Like the motivation is something that you can't learn. You have to be, you have it or you don't, I feel. And if you do feel motivation, then the easiest way to sort of demonstrate it is to produce some kind of projects, you know, be it creative work, be it, you know, some kind of web property tech or something like that, showing that you can think something through and then actualize it, you know, like actually produce and create something tangible, even if it is like a really basic web page or web app or something like that, shows a point of difference from a lot of designers who will come in and know how to push pixels around, like no worries, and know the sort of basic ins and outs of how to run a user research session, say, like a moderated task-based sort of session. But being able to actually produce something is a big differentiator. I also mentioned user research there. That's something that every designer should know how to do, in my opinion. Everyone should be comfortable putting their designs on a screen in front of a complete stranger who will then rip it to absolute shreds. I think as a designer, you know, you have to be able to hear negative criticism, and you have to be able to hear the word no, and and these kind of things, and you have to get used to it. And the only way to get used to do it to that is to hear it often, you know, to hear it a lot, and you build up a tolerance to it, and it'll affect you less, you know, and your sort of confidence and well-being. Basic training in user research, being able to run a moderated sort of user research session, that will hold you in very good stead as well.
You mentioned there my favorite word of the month, at least, which is the mid-level designer. So this really is what this entire series comes down to, is trying to understand what that actually means. And I think that the concept of a junior perhaps is fairly well established, or at the very least it's acknowledged that it's probably the first time you have done this thing. Whether it's the first time you've had a job or not is neither here nor there, but it's probably the first time you've done it. So when is, in your mind, is the transition period between being a junior and being a mid-level designer, and then what is a mid-level designer?
So I have thought about that on and off since I read the synopsis, essentially, of what guys are doing over there. And it's something that I've kind of struggled to define, because it's not something, obviously there's no, you don't go to, you know, karate and get to mid-level designer belt, which that would actually be great if there was some kind of guild that we could just use. And if you're wearing this special belt, then, you know, you're good to go. I think one of the things that really helped me mature past being a junior designer, which I spent a long time, I feel like, not in job title, but within myself, I definitely felt like I was in those heavy learning situations quite some time, you know, years. And I feel like when I successfully diverted a failure that I'd seen happen before, that's when I felt like, okay, I feel like I've got some kind of bead on how to do this. Because there was a situation that came up, I could remember from my own reflections and my own learnings that, okay, we went through this before. I remember how this communication goes, and what we really need to be doing is, you know, go and talk to, you know, put everything down now and go and talk to, you know, go to this stakeholder's office and go and, you know, have a conversation with them, or whatever it is. I feel like that was probably the moment where I kind of realized, oh, I actually do know something about this, and it's taken a long time to get to the point where I feel like I do, but it was that level of experience, which is a real cop-out when it comes to answering the question, right? Because the only way to kind of arrive at that moment is to go through a bunch of bullshit experiences, like, to have a lot of crappy jobs, or, you know, even just one crappy job where you learn about you know, the sort of dive bomb executive, or you learn about the BA who, you know, you have to literally sit next to and do their work for them to get them to do anything. You know, like, there's so many of those potential sort of pitfall situations. I think impossible to teach, because you can't instill the sort of feelings of anxiety and pressure without having that, the kind of job context around something.
Yeah, and you've got to have experienced it, right? It's stuff that happens to you, isn't it? That makes you the designer that you are. Mm. And I think one of the things that has really started to surface for me is this feeling of, it's not about duration necessarily, because someone could have a traumatic experience which really defines them as a character and means that they think in a particular way, which is more advanced than anybody else. But it's from a really short period of time, whereas someone else might have to go through smaller instances of those things over a longer duration to sort of reach the same level of maturity. If you're looking at the job market at the moment in Australia, do you see the term midway or mid-level designer being used as the descriptor for the person that a company is looking to hire?
Often in Australia, you will see mid/senior. Like, that is the one that you see on every contract, because they want to scoop up the people who will only charge them a mid-level rate.
Right.
but have a senior's level of experience. That's what you see in job ads in Australia. The hit the ground running thing is so much a part of that as well, you know, because there's always a shortening. The time is always getting shorter and scope is always increasing. So, you know, people in Australia, because the pool that we started with is quite small, the job market has always been very aggressive here. Like the market is, there's always demand. And that's kind of, maybe that's going back to a previous point that maybe that's why I didn't actually feel that daunting dread, anxiety about going out on my own, because I kind of felt always in the back of my head, well, if this actually goes tits up, then I can, you know, I could just look on Seek and call up the first recruiter I see and go and find a mid-senior job I'd be able to charge a bit for, and everything would be sweet, you know, like, so that's very much the pervasive terminology in Australia. I think because there is a shortage of those kind of people who have a lot of perspective and a lot of deep knowledge about a particular type of design, or, you know, design specialty or user research or that kind of thing.
Do you think that that is perhaps symptomatic of the maturity level of the market as a whole? Like you were saying before about how 5-10 years ago felt like things were a little bit behind, it's starting to pick up the pace. Has that been perhaps... the redeployment of citizens? Because I know a lot of people that I was talking to around about 2015, let's say, in England in particular, we were starting to go through some very curious political wranglings, which are, you know, which are still ongoing today. But it was actually, it did catalyze people to start thinking about ultimately going back home. And I knew a lot of Australian designers from New Zealand who all decided to start heading back, and they were saying that it was basically that London had reached very much a saturation point where you were pretty much fighting for every single contract, and there seemed to be this sea of stuff going on back home. And one of those people that said that the main reason was because everyone did the same thing. They finished school and then they went somewhere else to start their careers. So perhaps there's a knowledge gap somewhere going on in the Australian market, which is why there's this big swathe of mid/senior, because all of those people don't exist yet.
Yeah, or they did leave because, you know, a lot of my colleagues who I would consider to be the more competent and more, you know, worldly and more capable went to work for Amazon and went to work for Google and Facebook. The brain drain in Australia, in Australian technology, has been happening since the Australian technology sector came around. You know, like, people have been going to, you know, Oxford to do research. They've been going to San Francisco. They've been going to Seattle. Then that kind of, I think in some parts of the tech market has seen a bit of a rite of passage for a designer here to go and, you know, try and make it in one of those more global kind of companies in a more hot market. And it's quite interesting in Melbourne because we have the same effect with designers from New Zealand, because it's very easy for someone from New Zealand where there's you know, there's some work in New Zealand. There are software companies in New Zealand and, you know, obviously there's this big progressive internet presence there and so on. But there's much more, you know, there's five times as much work as there is in Australia. So we get a lot of Kiwi designers coming over and, they, you know, they suffered the same problems with brain drain that Australia does. And, yeah, I think you might be right in that that mid/senior role, the journeyman, you know, to use a very gender-biased phrase, that's that role in the sort of weathered practitioner. A very dented sword, but still a sword nonetheless, that would fill that role. So it's very interesting because there's never been a saturation of user experience practitioners or design practitioners or digital, you know, product people in Australia. If you are a competent front-end developer, project manager, designer, you know, product person, you name it, there's work to do in Australia. Because there are still a lot of organizations that are bringing themselves up to speed when it comes to maturity in this in this sector. But also because around that time, you're talking about maybe 20, maybe started earlier than 2015, but there was a kind of the first surge of like big Australian internet companies that went really global. Companies like 99 Designs or Redbubble or Atlassian is one, you know, from the later end of that. And you started to be able to do that kind of work in Australia. So, you know, I think Australia still doesn't nurture the kind of economy we need. And I disagree greatly with a lot of the policies that the government has, which encourages this kind of brain drain away from Australia. Because Australia, you know, is lovely. Like I've been to the UK and and America as well, but I think Australia is one of the, like, there's a lot of negative aspects of Australian culture that are difficult to contend with, as there is in a lot of cultures at the moment. But I still believe that it's one of the best places to live and work in the world at the moment, and I feel very lucky to live and work in Australia. You know, even though it's not San Francisco and it's not Seattle and it's not Vienna, Melbourne is the city that I love, and I love living here and working here because it's, you know, I can do the work that I want to do and still be in Australia. If things descend further in the US and further in the UK when the cat stops staring at the door and actually goes out of the door, I think that it might trigger, you know, a reversal of this brain drain. So I'm very apprehensive about that as a businessman.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The UX Coach. If you're new here, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your feeds from. You can also sign up to our monthly newsletter featuring the best posts from around the world on digital careers and practices. Just visit our website, theuxcoach.com. We want to give a voice to the often unheard stars of this field. If you'd like to join the conversation on digital design and research careers, get in touch with us at our website, theuxcoach.com. I'll be back in a few weeks with more conversations on careers in this new digital landscape. So until then, keep it locked.